It is time for the single coolest sports show in the country, The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics.
You've got Matt Bonner, who my notes tell me is a sandwich blogger named Red Mamba. I mean, how can you not like a guy like that?
And the Red Rocket knocks down the triple.
Red Rocket, I'm telling you, Red Mamba might not miss a shot.
Just like in politics, in the instructional video business, you need credibility.
You want credibility? I'll give you credibility. Hey, Tim, what's my nickname?
The Red Rocket.
No.
The Sandwich Hunter.
No. Fry Gun.
The Medium Fundamental.
And welcome to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I'm Chris Ryan here in the great states of New Hampshire. Matt is down in Texas. The NBA season, boys and girls, is, believe it or not that far away, with a training camp just around the corner for the Celtics, Spurs, and the rest of the NBA, and of course, college football got started. The NFL starting this week with the Patriots taking on the Kansas City Chiefs. Baseball's postseason is getting into the picture here. So there's a lot of things going on in sports. Welcome in Matt from Texas. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. Appreciate you joining us for the program. What's the vibe been like down there? Obviously, you're far removed, so to speak, from Houston. It's about the same distance from San Antonio to Houston as it is from, here to New York City. So it's maybe the same state, but it's a big state. And there's obviously a lot of land in between San Antonio and Houston. But what's been the vibe like in San Antonio so far?
Well, you're right. It is like a two and a half, 3 hour drive to Houston. But in Texas terms, that's really close. You know, when you grow up in New England, geographically speaking, if you're driving 3 hours, that's a long trip.
I have made the drive from Houston to San Antonio, yeah, and I will say it is not three, and it's like four. I thought it was going to be like three and a half hours. It was long. I will look it up on my phone right now.
It's like 2.5, 3 hours.
All right.
The speed limit's 75. The speed limit's 75 in Texas. I think even 80 in some parts.
I think I got a ticket as well on that trip.
So that's fine. But anyways, my point was, it's all relative. Like in Texas, a 3 hour drive is nothing. It's like, I'll commute 3 hours to go to work. No big deal. I'll commute 3 hours to go to the grocery store. Well, maybe not that, but it's definitely felt here in San Antonio more, just because everybody has friends, colleagues, family in Houston. And then also what's not getting as much coverage is all the coastal towns. Corpus Christi, that whole stretch on the coast got absolutely just leveled. They didn't get the flooding like Houston got, but the wind, the structural damage is insane. One of my friends who works, who runs a charity, brought six truckloads of supplies and water and food and clothes and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, you going to Houston? And he's like, no, I'm going down to the coast. And he was down there.
Mm-hmm.
He was sending me pictures of just building after building after building that was just shredded, just in shambles, just in a heap of wood. So it's the media is showing you Houston, but the effects are much more far reaching. As far as direct effects here in San Antonio, there's no gas.
Mm-hmm.
We got here, and luckily, one of my cars was full, and then our family mobile was on low gas, and I drove around for about 45 minutes looking for gas, and, the first three or four gas stations I went to were all out, and then I found one that had gas, but it was like, there must have been 300 cars, in line waiting to get gas, and my tank was on E, so I had to bring that car back. Switched out, drove all around, and found like a little gas station kind of more off the beaten path that had gas. So I filled up, drove back at the other car, drove all the way across town, filled that one up. And by the time I got back with the second car, the only gas they had left was premium. They were out of the first two, 87 and 89 or whatever, octane. And now there's just like no gas anywhere.
Was that the first time you'd ever purchased premium gasoline?
Chris, come on. My Chevy Impala is a finely tuned machine. It needs the finest of fuels to run efficiently. Come on. But anyways, they're saying it's not a gas shortage, but it's one of those things where, like, if everybody panics,
right,
and goes, then all the gas is gone. Now we have now. I don't know. I guess, you know, people have been showing pictures of gas trucks leaving Houston for the other cities in Texas, but they're still, as of this morning, so all the gas stations are all out of gas. So I'm hoping they get more before everybody's tanks start to run out.
Well, I'd like to extend a heartfelt apology to Matt because it is actually, he was right. It's 2 hours and 50 minutes, according to Google Maps, from San Antonio to Houston. So not only was he right when he said 2.5-3 hours, but he was, you know, pretty much exactly right, because you would assume that it's kind of halfway in between if you say 2.5-3 hours. And 197 miles, so yeah, it's I was wrong. I apologize for that. That we'll kind of move forward from there. So it is closer from Houston to San Antonio than it is from here to New York City. It's more like, you know, here to Montreal, somewhere around that range. But it is far. You get what I'm saying. I went a little exaggerated a little bit, but it's not like they're like right next to each other. But obviously, there's that relative proximity. It's interesting about the gas aspect of things, because, you know, obviously, first and foremost, it's been, you know, watching the imagery and thinking about the individuals who have suffered. But obviously, you know, you wonder, as everybody does here in New England, how is this possibly going to affect me? And we've seen, you know, a 31-cent increase in gas over the last week since Harvey and, Labor Day as well. And there's a significant amount of production that comes out of Houston. So is basically all of, not all of, but a significant amount of Texas's gas come from Houston? So that's, people started to worry.
That's where all the refineries are. I think
right.
That whole kind of Port Arthur, Beaumont, down into Louisiana, that whole Gulf area is where most of the nation's gas, you know, not just the U.S., but Canada, too, draws from these refineries. So when they their production is interrupted, it has a widespread effect across the whole country. And then it's interesting, like human psychology, you know, it literally takes, like, one person to send out a tweet or start the rumor that there's a gas shortage, and then everybody panics and goes to get gas and causes the gas shortage. Whereas if everybody just stayed normal, it'd be fine. And it's one of those things, like, all right, I have 3/4 of a tank of gas, but I'm driving around and I'm seeing hour long lines of cars going to get gas. I'm thinking to myself, man, if I see a gas station, I better fill up. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
It's just like the psychology of panic. It just spreads, and everybody uses up all the gas and there's no more gas. The same thing with water or bread or any time. It just takes like a few people to start, and then it just spreads like wildfire. It's been kind of interesting to witness.
This is a really, you know, good point, and one that I've been talking about a lot on the political side of things, but it's true in sports and in disasters and all sorts of things where, you know, in the past, there was kind of a gatekeeper in the mainstream media or at a talk radio station or wherever that, you know, could stop the flow of fake information. I hate the fake news term for obvious reasons, but fake information or things that just weren't true from being spread.
Rumors.
And now rumors have become, you know, the mainstream. There was the guy who decided he was going to pretend that he saw a shark on I-10 or whatever in Houston. Did you see that? So there was a picture of a shark in the water that got spread like wildfire. There was a shark in the water in Houston. And we see this, you know, we see it all the time where people will spread these stories that either fit their narrative or whatever that aren't true about people. And, you know, it used to be in the past that there was somebody that could, you know, if somebody wrote a crazy letter to the editor, guess what? They said, we're not going to put this in the newspaper. But now somebody can write whatever they want and put it out there. And the problem, which is fine, and that's part of America, the problem is that we have a country right now where people aren't smart enough to and educated enough to discern what is and be the gatekeeper for themselves, so to speak, and say, okay, well, this is not true and this is true. And no matter how much you may push news now in the mainstream media, There's a negative connotation about that, where certainly there's a slant at times from the left to the right, but everything that you're getting is fact-based or information that is reliable, where there's a huge difference between what you get from New York Times as compared to some guy on Facebook.
But even that's under attack and getting muddled. You know, the President of the United States is constantly calling the New York Times, the Washington Post,
CNN,
multiple other credible national publications with a long tradition of honor and fact-checking and sources, that he's calling them fake news and made-up stuff. So now, you know, if you're starting at the very top and
right,
discrediting the media, and on top of that, you got, you know, all the social media rumors starting going on, no one knows what's real, you know, and it's created a huge issue where the media, like you said, is being a gatekeeper and, you know, kind of checks and balances with politicians, with events, with whatever's going on. It's just all over the place and run amok and caused a lot of confusion, I think.
Right, and there are no facts. Well, there are facts, but there's no agreeable facts anymore. And now people are arguing over, you know, whether a fact is a fact or whether the fiction is the fact, where I used to have an argument about, you know, how to solve problems based upon the facts from different ideologies. It's like in sports where if a guy walks up to Matt Bonner and says, you know what, Tim Duncan's overrated, he was garbage, and you just walk away because you know it's different, but because you know that's not the truth. But now you have an argument where somebody can bring something up and it's taken for truth because of whatever, because that's how it fits a person's beliefs, where I used to be able to just kind of distinguish the fact from the fiction. All right, we'll move off of the pontiff's.
You talk about that all day.
And go into a little sports right now. And, you know, last week on the show, I was not ready to be all that concerned about the Red Sox. And, you know, they had a good week going into Yankee Stadium. They gotten swept by the Baltimore Orioles, and they went to Toronto, and they beat the Blue Jays three straight. They went into New York to take on the Yankees. And the problem for me is not necessarily the Red Sox lost 3 of 4 to the Yankees. They still have a 3.5-game lead in the division and, you know, look pretty good for the playoffs under a month to go here in the season. The concern is, you know, we've been waiting for Mookie, I've been waiting for Xander to hit. And, you know, we just haven't seen that. And to see Chris Sale get knocked around by the Yankees at two difficult starts against the Cleveland Indians. And, you know, we'll see what happens over the next couple weeks. But I'm still waiting to see how the Red Sox are going to be a really good postseason team. You know, are their starters going to be able to match up with the opposing team starters, and the Red Sox be able to squeak out a win? Are they going to outscore the opposing team, which doesn't happen all that much in the postseason? Is it going to be intangibles? Is it going to be bullpen? I'm still waiting for kind of the Red Sox identity, you know, to step forward here post David Ortiz, and I just don't know what they're going to be able to do and accomplish in the postseason if, you know, Hanley, Mookie, Xander, you know, don't hit. That's going to be a problem.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on the hitting front. I've always been of the opinion, just as a casual baseball fan, I'm not an expert by any means, but if your starting pitchers are dominant, you know, if you can have two dominant starting pitchers in the postseason, you're going to have a really good chance to win a 7-game series in advance, just because, you know, they shorten the starting pitcher rotation, and when those guys pitch, they'll be able to keep the run total low. And even if you're not the hottest, you know, at bat, because the run total's low, it'll keep you in the game and give you a chance to find a way to get wins. So I'm kind of more interested on that side of things going into postseason. But you're absolutely right. It's been a waiting game. And it hasn't happened, so at this point, it's the obvious question is maybe it's not going to. Maybe it is what it is. But you know, like any baseball fan, you hold out hope. You're happy they're going to the postseason, first of all, and then you hold out hope that they're that one team that kind of gets hot and catches fire and finds a groove and rips through the playoffs and wins the World Series.
Right, and the thing is, though, you hope that, but for the Red Sox, I'm still looking for, you know, the evidence, as we mentioned before. I mean, Eduardo Nunez, without him, the Yankees would be in first place right now. Eduardo Nunez has won them games, and congratulations to Dave Dombrowski for pulling off a great deal and bringing him in and recognizing that and having everything kind of work out. But it's not just, you know, the Yankees now either. The Yankees are 3.5 games behind, but the Red Sox are losing ground to Houston, and they're losing ground to Cleveland. And home field advantage, it means a lot in baseball. You want to have game 5 or a game 7 or 6 and 7 on your home field. And the Red Sox and the Indians are even, I would say. The Indians have obviously won 11 in a row, so you're looking at them right now and you're, you know, kind of taken back by how good that they've been playing. But I think that the Red Sox and Indians are pretty even. But I feel, you know, feel much better if the Red Sox are playing Game 5 in Boston as compared to in Cleveland. And you look right now, and Sale has been struggling here against the Indians and also the Yankees this last start, where he gave up the 3 home runs. And Corey Kluber has been great. And so you match those two guys up in Games 1 and 5, and then you go through the rest of the series. You're like, Pomerantz, I feel pretty good about him. Then where is the Red Sox rotation? Doug Fister's been really good for them as of late, so he probably, if the season ended today, would find a playoff spot in either the third or fourth game. Rick Porcello's been okay. Eduardo Rodriguez has been okay. But you're not confident in, you know, the starting rotation being able to shut things down and give you a chance, particularly against a lineup like Cleveland or Houston. You have Houston picking up Justin Verlander, and, you know, the evidence right now is not in favor of, you know, the best wishes, I think, for Red Sox fans. Because I thought that Verlander pickup for Houston, which happened right at the end of the waiver deadline, was huge. I mean, they're a team that has a lot of depth offensively, and now you have, you know, 2, 3, 4 guys in that rotation who could match up with anybody.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, you think of all the great, not all the great, but most teams that go on to win a World Series, like I said, have at least 2 dominant starting pitchers that they put in that playoff rotation. And you got to wonder if the Red Sox have enough in that department going into this postseason to be able to match up pitching-wise with some of these other teams.
All right, we'll talk with Red Sox catcher Christian Vasquez here in the middle segment of the program, and also a former Patriots quarterback, Steve Grogan, will get us from, we remember, back
Steve
in our
Grogan.
Day.
Wow.
Steve Grogan's on the show to talk about the Pats.
From the past.
Is Tom Brady the greatest of all time? We'll ask Steve Grogan. Is he going to go on and say Brady's the greatest? Or is he going to go old school NFL guy and pick somebody from back in his day and say
Johnny Unitas
wasn't quite in his day. I would say Joe Montana.
Joe Namath.
Y.A. Tittle. I'm going to ask him who's better. Actually, I already know this since it already happened, but I'm going to ask him who's better. Brady or Montana? There we go. That's his time period versus today, but it's Patriots versus... We'll see how he answers it. This is the Life of Matt Bonner presented by Concord Orthopedics. Welcome back here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. This segment of the show presented by Revision Energy. What can sunshine do for you? Aaron Judge hit a 2-run homer during a 6th-run, 6th inning as the Yankees roughed up the Red Sox 9-2 in the Bronx. Chase Headley, Matt Holliday, and Todd Frazier all hit solo home runs for New York, which took 2 out of 3 in the series. Luis Severino allowed only an unearned run in the 6th inning to move to 12-6 on the year. Sandy Leon singled a run for Boston, which now has only a 3.5-game lead over the Yankees in the AL East. Chris Sale allowed 3 runs in less than 5 innings to fall to 15-7 on the season.
That's what this game is about, is adjusting. And you know, they were putting long, good at-bats together, you know, fouling some pitches off, taking some good pitches. So, you know, it was up to me to, you know, make a mid-game adjustment. Clearly, I didn't.
Red Sox manager John Farrell says the Yankees wore Chris Sale out.
On a couple of home runs, there were some pitches out over the plate they got extended on. Breaking ball 0-2 to Headley, fastball that trying to go in on Holliday for another one. And they ran the pitch count up. High number of foul balls. You know, he threw a lot of pitches over the plate.
Yankees first baseman Chase Headley says Matt Holliday has given him a boost in his return. Holiday had a big three-run home run on Saturday and another home run last night.
It's a small sample size, but obviously, you know, two games and two home runs, you know, against good pitching, you know, that's encouraging. But I think, you know, he's a professional and he knows how to have quality at bats.
The Yankees looking pretty good right now, as down Yankee Stadium this past weekend, and the additions of Matt Holliday as well as Starlin Castro have been injured through the course of this season, coupled with the fact that Masahiro Tanaka is pitching much better, makes the Yankees a formidable team down the stretch of this season. Now, granted, the Red Sox have a nice lead. They have a nice lead with a month to go in the season of 3.5 games. And I think if you look at the two teams and compare them right now, as that series showed, the Yankees were a little ahead of the Red Sox. And same thing I thought in regards to the trade deadline, but then they had injuries, and that obviously affected them. But Sonny Gray, a decent start Friday night for the Yankees. He's been good. Severino was good last night. They have the pitching. Judge has obviously cooled off a lot. They're going to have to deal with the suspension of Gary Sanchez. But overall, I mean, if I'm a Yankees fan, I'm feeling pretty good right now about this team going down the stretch. The Orioles are hot, but they don't have the same type of talent the Yankees have. But that'll play out on the field as they play two series against each other. So the wild card is up for grabs. The division is still there, too. I mean, the Yankees are still within shouting distance of the Red Sox. Red Sox have to put them away by beating bad teams like the ones that are coming in here over the next stretch, like the Toronto Blue Jays, like the Tampa Bay Rays, like the Oakland Athletics. Red Sox need to go to work here over this this homestand, and obviously it needs to start against the Blue Jays, where they did play very well last week up in Toronto north of the border. Here's my conversation with Red Sox catcher Christian Vasquez. Of course, been great for the Red Sox this year about the games getting a little bit more intensified as September and October baseball is upon us.
It's obviously the reason, you know, you play baseball, to have meaningful games in September and October. What did you notice that changes about the game, kind of in the intensity or how much each pitch means, you know, down the stretch, and how does that affect you?
Yeah, it means a lot. You know, we're in the end of the season and, you know, we're fighting for first place and, you know, we're playing great baseball, this team, and, you know, everybody's together in the boat and, you know, we need to keep fighting and, you know, be together.
How big was that series up in Toronto? Obviously, you guys had lost four straight. It didn't feel like the team was in sort of a tailspin at that point, but you needed to kind of obviously redirect and get winning again. You had that big game, obviously, on Monday going 4-for-4. That seemed like a pretty big series for this team to kind of reestablish themselves.
Yeah, of course. You know, every win matters, man, and get that 3 straight wins in Toronto, you know, pump everybody up and, you know, get back in track.
Is that kind of the story of the team this year? When you have faced adversity, you've been able to respond. I mean, there's not been a losing streak beyond 4 games, winning games late, and that obviously bodes well for a postseason where, you know, you're going to face obviously a lot of adversity within the course of even a game or a 5-game series.
Yeah, you know, like I say, it's stay together and, you know, trust each other, you know, and have fun, man, because if you get stressed, the things are not going the right way. So, and, you know, I think that's the key, man, and have fun and enjoy the game and, you know, everybody do their job and, you know, we're going to be fine.
A lot of baseball coaches, you know, like watching you and like watching your Pedroia as well, as guys who they can point to kids and say, okay, this is how you play the game. And for you, from the catching perspective and the fundamental side of things, where did you know, start to establish your base? Like, at what age did you start to become, you know, the guy that we see today? Was it when you were younger, during the minor leagues? At what point in time did you kind of establish being the Christian Vasquez we see here today?
I think when I started playing more in the minor leagues, you know, they gave me more opportunity to play, and I was the third catcher in rookie ball, and, you know, I never played a lot. But when they put me more in the lineup, I think that helped me a lot to put myself and think to myself, you know, I can do this and be a big leaguer and good catcher.
The final thing, I mean, the story for you has been responding to adversity, much like the club this year. You mentioned, you know, as you came through rookie ball, third string catcher, obviously coming off of the Tommy John, where you'd be able to reestablish yourself. I mean, do you feel like at this point where, when you do in the future down the road have a moment where you're down again, that you have, you know, the confidence to overcome that based upon, you know, the path that you've taken as a player?
Yeah. You know, I have a lot of up and downs in my careers. You know, that's normal for everybody. So, but yeah, when I get the chance to play, you know, I get my 100% and want to be the best player, you know, I can be, and you know, show everybody I can do this.
All right, that is Red Sox catcher Christian Vasquez. Of course, has had a great year for Boston. Of course, a lot of excitement of the Patriots starting their season this week against the Kansas City Chiefs. The banner going up, and the Patriots defending that Super Bowl championship, looking to go back to back and to win a sixth ring this season. Here is Steve Grogan, who was of course a great former Patriots quarterback who was at the State House for an event with Patriots owner Bob Kraft last week.
1-2. I'm joined by one of the great all-time New England Patriots and Steve Grogan here at the State House celebrating the birth of a new scratch game and participating in a little bit of an orientation and a clinic with some youth football players. And what's it like for you to have the opportunity to give back and to particularly connect with a younger generation of football players?
Oh, it's a lot of fun. We do these clinics and camps around New England free for kids in the communities all summer. We don't all do every camp, but we've got at least 25 of them throughout New England, and it's just a lot of fun to work with young players. They don't have a clue who we are anymore, but the parents most of the time do. So it's just fun to get out and teach kids a little bit about the game of football, which is such a great game.
Indeed, and you know, one of the aspects too that you focus on is player safety, and you know, players of your generation obviously have experienced a lot of the downsides of football. And is that something that you know, share with kids as well about the game?
Not so much that. It's, you know, that the organizations, the leagues take care of that kind of thing. We just try to teach them some skills to do how to do things the right way. And the biggest thing is they need to have fun. Football's a great game. You can learn a lot of different things that can't be taught in the classroom. And you know, relying on other people, teamwork, confidence, courage, that kind of thing. If we can just impart a few of those on them, they'll enjoy football and they'll play it safely.
As a guy that played 16 years with the Patriots, did you ever anticipate what this franchise has become under Bob Kraft, where this would be, you know, the staple for football? Obviously, there's a lot of pride with what the Patriots accomplished during your era, particularly in these parts, but this has become kind of a juggernaut. It's become, you know, the Yankees of football, so to speak.
Never in my right mind did I imagine this, and it's just been a lot of fun. It's, you know, we kind of coattail with them, the success they're having, our alumni group. Gets to do a lot of things because of the success they're having now, and I just hope they can keep it going. But kids are spoiled now. They think it's going to happen every year, and it's pretty special. It's not happening every year.
And you know how hard it is to make it, you know, to the Super Bowl. And, you know, for most kids my age, you remember, you know, the Super Bowl, obviously, against the Bears. And it took so long for the Patriots to get to that point. Great players, great teams, yourself, Stanley Morgan, Ray Claiborne. I mean, so many guys, Andre Tippett, you know, Bruce Armstrong stand out. But it takes a lot to get to that point. And you start, particularly with Boston sports overall, you start to expect that one of these teams is going to make it to a championship and win it.
No, it's become the accepted and not the unexpected. And like I said, I don't think people understand, especially young people, how hard it is to get there. It'll be interesting to see what happens when Belichick and Brady decide to leave the team, because they're the two major keys to the success they've had. And once they're gone, things could change quickly.
When you look at Brady, what do you see? You played, obviously, against Montana. You played against, you know, some of the greats of that era. And everybody, obviously, particularly in this region, views Brady as the greatest of all time. Are you in that boat?
Oh, without a doubt. He's for 17 years now, he's done things that that I know are not easy and makes them look easy. He's smart, he's quick, he makes decisions in a hurry. He's also played in the same offense for 17 mm-hmm. years, which most people don't get to do, but he's just the best ever, in my opinion.
Final thing, I think that people are downplaying a little bit the significance of Edelman going down, because Brady has always had that guy underneath that he loved, whether it was a number of guys early on, whether it was Deion Branch, Troy Brown, guys like that, and on to, you know, Wes Welker after that, and now Edelman filling that role. That's the guy you could rely on third and short, which the Patriots get themselves in those situations a lot. Do you see another guy on this roster who's going to step into that role, or are they going to have to adapt to not having Edelman?
I don't know that anybody can do what Edelman does. Amendola, maybe a little bit. Yeah. He's that small, quicker kind of guy. But the great thing about Bill Belichick and Tom Brady is they adjust their plans to who they have playing, and I think they'll make some adjustments and move on and still be successful without him.
Yeah, I see White and Lewis out of the backfield potentially kind of taking that mantle.
A lot of that, you know, Gronkowski goes down a couple times over the last few years, and they've figured out ways to get it done without him. They'll figure out ways to get it done without Edelman.
Steve, thanks a lot. Enjoy your time here in Concord.
Thank you.
All right, that is former Patriots quarterback Steve Grogan here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. This segment of the show presented by Revision Energy. What can sunshine do for you? Coming up next, more with Matt on the Patriots and the Celtics when we return. Here, you're listening to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics, and that segment of the show brought to you by Revision Energy. Welcome back here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. This segment of the show brought to you by the Prescription Center, as we get set for Patriots 2017 and into 18 action. And we'll talk a little bit about the Celtics trade becoming finalized as Gordon Hayward, as well as Kyrie Irving, introduced to the Boston media on Friday. And Matt rejoins us here from Texas. So we'll start with the Pats. And as is the case usually here in New England, people pretty confident about the Patriots going into this year. And the baseline for a Patriots conversation starts with whether or not the Patriots are going to go undefeated, 19-0 this season.
Oh, my goodness.
Which just, you know, you're certain to have disappointment if you're starting with that.
So either that's a wicked high bar.
Yeah, I mean, either you reach the bar and you're like, okay, they reached the bar, or they didn't reach the bar. But obviously the potential exists with this team. But as I mentioned with Grogan, I don't think that it should be understated how significant the loss is of Julian Edelman, where, you know, there's this feeling that the Patriots can, no matter what, they can kind of compensate for whatever happens, and they have great depth. They do. But, I mean, that's a great player, and it's not only a great player, but that's the guy for Tom Brady on third and five. I mean, that's the guy that he's going to. That's the guy that he's confident in, and he has that taken away. Now, certainly, you know, Brandon Cooks came in. Amendola can fill that spot. Gronkowski's back and hopefully healthy. James White and Deion Lewis are going to help him out of the backfield. There'll be some surprises, as there always are, but the Edelman loss is pretty significant.
Yeah, he's a rock in that offense. Like you said, the go-to guy and sit those third downs when Brady knows he needs to count on someone to make a play. Edelman's that guy. And not to mention, team chemistry-wise, I think he's an emotional leader.
Yeah.
You know, that's a huge loss. Obviously, the Pats have dealt with losses like this many times in the past and overcome them. So it'll be interesting to see what adjustments are made and who steps up in his absence.
So I think the 19-0 discussion is kind of, you know, is pretty crazy, but you know what? It's doable. The Patriots,
I agree, but I don't think they care. Like, they want to win.
Right.
The Super Bowl. So if they're 15-0, or if they're 17-0 and they have first place locked up, you think Brady's playing all four quarters of the last two games? I doubt it. They're concerned with the process, and the process isn't going 19-0. If it happens, I think it's one of those things, if it happens, great, but that's not their goal when they set out in training camp. Their goal is, like I said, to win a championship. So that's for us to talk about. It'll be funny to see if they start running them off and the media starts trying to broach the subject with Belichick and Brady and those guys to see their response and kind of prove the point, like, if they want to win a Super Bowl, that's what they're focused on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they, this is going to be kind of like, you know, threading the needle here, but I think they want to go 19-0, but they're going to go through the process to get to that point. I mean, in order to go 19-0, you have to focus on the Chiefs and then the Saints and the Texans and the Panthers. I think that that's, I wouldn't say it's not a goal for Tom Brady. I think that it is, but it's a goal that comes from, you know, this, again, this is kind of threading the needle, but it's a goal that comes from the process. Right. And I mean, you look at you go through the Patriots schedule this year and the AFC East is not very good. They have some tough games at the Steelers. That's a tough game in December. The Falcons in Foxborough.
The Falcons are going to be champing at the bit.
Yes, and that's going to be.
Can you imagine?
That's going to be a tough game, and the Patriots could. You know, the Tampa is a tougher game than you might think too, because Tampa had a decent year. Last year, but overall,
yeah, they have a reality show now on HBO.
Yeah, and so they're big. But overall, this schedule is not very. You know, there's no NFC real powerhouses on this schedule other than the Falcons. They play in a bad division. They go to the Raiders, and that could be tough. At Denver is always tough. But there's not. You don't look at the and I think that's it's mostly a product of the Patriots where. You know, the Patriots are, let's face it, they are the, you know, kind of the Golden State Warriors of the NFL. I don't think there's any question about that.
Well, I would say the San Antonio Spurs, but you can, potato, potato.
Right. Well, you know, I'm not gonna get into, you know, putting down the San Antonio Spurs here, but, you know.
I'm referring to the
pedigree?
Long-term.
I mean, like, right now. I mean, like. In terms of we've talked about that. The Spurs, and there's a lot of synergy between the Spurs and the Patriots. There's no question, you know, about that. Well, the Spurs are in a little bit of a different time period here post Tim Duncan, although obviously Coach Pop is still there. But no, I mean, like, right now, the Warriors are the class of the NBA, and it's everybody else trying to get
you.
A little what they got.
Okay.
But yeah.
Yep. Can't really argue with that one right now.
Yeah.
So, I'll give that one to you.
So. The other thing now is that the Celtics trade has people very, very excited. And that's great. I mean, it's great that everybody's excited. But I'm going to throw a little cold water on the Celtics situation. And you know what? Brad Stevens did too. Brad Stevens is going to said pretty much exactly the same thing that I was thinking and am now going to say. So I feel somewhat rewarded in my mindset. I mean, this team has never done anything together before. I mean, no one has any idea how this is going to play out. I mean, everybody can expect what's going to happen, but this team is coming together for the first time. There's only four guys who were on the Celtics last year who are going to be on this team. So, you know, who's going to rebound? How well are they going to defend as a unit? You know, who's going to play the two guard spot? I mean, there's still a lot of questions about, you know, this Celtics team. Now, you would assume that Hayward and Kyrie and Horford are all going to mesh really well together, and they're all smart guys, they're all team guys. You know, there's obviously some concern, as there was when Chris Sale came to Boston, about how things ended there in Cleveland with Kyrie. But I think the key point is that, you know, before you project what this team is going to do and what they're going to be and go crazy about how good they're going to be, there's going to be some struggles early on for this team. And it's very difficult to say how good they're going to be based upon the fact they never played together.
You're absolutely right. There's going to be an adjustment period, chemistry-wise, role-wise, guys figuring out where they fit in, how they can be most effective, and finding their identity. You know, fact of the matter is Isaiah Thomas and even Jay Crowder, to a certain extent, were kind of set the tone, emotional leaders, really gave the Celtics their identity, especially down the stretch in games. So now you have a new cast of characters that are going to have to fill those shoes. And I got to be honest with you, in my opinion, there's a lot of pressure on Kyrie Irving. He came in for arguably the second most beloved athlete in all of New England.
Yeah.
And Isaiah Thomas, you know, Tom Brady being first at this point, heart and soul of the team. of the community, had huge games, won huge games for him down the stretch with his performance, an underdog. And, you know, he's going to have to step in and, as a point guard, you would think, take that leadership position on the court, in the locker room, and keep the Celtics atop the East and give them a chance to win a championship.
Yeah, you are spot on, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on Kyrie. I think that, you know, you can rely, you can pretty much project Kyrie and Gordon Hayward based upon what they've done in the past, and they're going to be good. The question, again, is the team chemistry overall, and, you know, who's going to fill what roles on this team, and how good is Markieff Morris going to be? Is Jason Tatum going to be a significant player, as a lot of people are projecting? A lot of people around here really like Jaylen Brown. I think the jury's still out on Jaylen Brown, and I've seen signs that he's going to be a good player. I liked how he adopted the three-point shot and was hitting that consistently. But, you know, there were some times, as a rookie or 19-year-old is going to, that he looked kind of lost out there. So there's still kind of questions as to what his role is going to be moving forward. You know, Terry Rozier, I think, had a nice year last year. Marcus Smart has proven what he is going to be as an NBA player. And that's a very valuable team, a guy who makes plays down the stretch on the defensive side of things. But again, I mean, how is everybody going to mesh together, and who's going to fill the roles outside of the new big three, if you will? And that to me is what's going to be most interesting. And how is the roster going to, the rotation and the roster going to mold together? Because this is a completely new team.
Right. You know, we're talking about the stars, but even the bench and the role players and all that whole secondary rotation of guys has to be figured out as well. And, you know, the Celtics do have young talent, and that it will be an interesting development and storyline this season to see which of those young guys kind of emerges and takes that big step forward and increases their role and their production. They obviously have a lot of guys with the potential to do so, but, you know, having potential and fulfilling potential are two different things, the latter being very difficult at that level. But I got to think someone's going to step up and have a big year. So I'll be curious to see who it is.
And in conclusion, the other big storyline is going to be the Celtics are still one piece away from winning a championship, in my view, and I think Danny Ainge's view too. And, you know, what happens with Anthony Davis in New Orleans? Is there any chance they can pry Marc Gasol away from Memphis? That's going to be the other aspect here. Are you know, the Celtics done, or is there going to be an opportunity during the course of the season to find that another big and to, you know, fully solidify a championship roster?
They have the assets to do it.
Right.
Flexibility. It's interesting to see what materializes. Next offseason is going to be crazy. I mean, tons of superstars coming on the free agent market. Tons more the potential to come on the free agent market if they opt out or don't extend this year. So it'll, and I think it's supposed to be a good draft too, if I'm not mistaken. So a lot of different things in play next offseason. I'll be curious to see what happens with the Celtics.
And Celtics did trade the Nets pick, but still have the other protected number one choice in the lottery they acquired for trading the number one overall this year. Matt, as always, appreciate you joining us for the program.
All right, thanks for having me.
This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. That segment of the show presented by the Prescription Center.